Hello, how are you?
Jerry,
We're wonderful, Jerry.
You are like you're bigger than LA Law. Like you're a rock star of the law world.
Well, my closing arguments are a little longer than they are in the LA Law, too.
Well, Jerry, we've seen you in action in the Netflix show called Making a Murderer, which has been unbelievable to sit down. I watched that with my family, would you believe? And we were
it's
all
a great
into it.
Family viewing.
But so what I've seen you in action, I'm just thinking when you come out to Australia that you might be a chance of representing me with a couple of parking fines.
Sometimes I long for something that simple.
Oh, fantastic. I can imagine. I've got a heap of them.
I mean, the Stephen Avery case, as we've all seen, was torturous. My first big question, Jerry, and I'm sure you've been asked this many times, is why didn't Stephen take the stand?
Well, you know, I can't answer questions that go directly to attorney-client privilege. You know, the questions that I had with him. But, you know, I can answer in general that in any criminal case, those are always, you know, difficult, challenging questions or decisions that people have to make. And sometimes it's, you know, it's really a catch-22. If someone doesn't testify, they think, well, what has he got to hide? Even though the judge gives them an instruction saying you have a constitutional right not to testify because we want to make the state prove it, prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But other times when a defendant does testify, their testimony is discounted by jurors because they say, oh, well, of course he's going to say that, or he's going to lie to save his own skin. So you don't get the same sort of measure of credibility that other people would when you're a criminal defendant in a case. So it's a tough call that anyone has to make, and, you know, it's never anything that's done lightly.
Yeah, but, like, I just think that it was so his truth that he's innocent that would they couldn't trip him up.
No,
what I mean? Because you weren't there. You didn't do it. Whatever question you throw at me, you're not going to trip me up because this is my truth. Because watching it, and I know that a lot of people are saying this documentary is very one-sided, but I'm just like, are you kidding me? Can this really happen to a person?
It's terrifying.
And this is my question.
Actually.
Like, and looking at the documentary and it being out there, can this help him at all? Because when it is laid out in this documentary, and I know it's edited, you know, and you know, people have put it together, but there is no question in, I don't think anyone that's seen its mind, that he isn't innocent. So could anything...
Or that he wasn't proven guilty. Yeah,
that he wasn't, reasonable doubt. So can this help him or not?
Well, I think it can help him in the long run. I mean, he now has a new attorney, a team of lawyers that are working, you know, that have had success in other cases like this. And, you know, the public is more aware of what he went through and where the biases exist. And the general public from which the jury was drawn really knew nothing about the case other than the false narrative that was presented by the special prosecutor in those press conferences, in which later was disproved by the lack of evidence that would corroborate it. No blood anywhere in the bedroom or anywhere in the house. Mm-hmm. But that's all that the media reported over and over and over for 10 months. And that's what everybody heard and everybody thought. And then they had the advantage of never having to call the witnesses who took the statement from Brendan Dassey in Stephen Avery's trial. So we had a more difficult burden trying to disprove that belief that was embedded in everybody's mind.
It's propaganda. You know, it's PR. It's basically PR. It was like a campaign that people believed, like, after a while, you know?
Yeah.
So, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Jerry, so, you know, watching the documentary from the start, the reason why we all come to the conclusion in the second, the case which you were working on, that there's reasonable doubt there is because of what we see happen to Stephen in his first stint in jail, where he was incarcerated
for 18 years.
Yeah, and as it turns out, he didn't do it at all. And that was due to a whole lot of people in that county getting together, you know, with they didn't like Stephen and really putting him together.
Yeah.
So from that, and you've seen that, and that's what we take on board. So what you've seen of watching the show since, do you feel that it represents what was going on in that time when you were involved?
I do. I think the documentary really is very fairly balanced. I mean, obviously there were some things that were left out because it was a 6-week trial and they had to condense it down into a 10-hour documentary. But the items of evidence that were most in dispute were covered well. Yeah. In fact, the items that the special prosecutor and his disinformation campaign afterwards, that he now argues were, you know, this big crucial evidence for the state that was left out, in reality, they were presented, first of all, it was never presented at trial, and those issues that were presented at trial that were neutralized by the defense cross-examination and pointing out the problems with that evidence. Mm. To such a degree that in the closing argument, the prosecutor spent almost no time on those issues.
Yep.
So, you know, from now say that these were real critical pieces of fact and evidence that were left out of the documentary unfairly really doesn't fit with the reality at all.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, okay. I've got a question about Brendan's case. So there was that four-hour video that they said they were going to play in court showing the detectives in there basically putting the words in his mouth.
Yeah, they did.
And then there was the part where his mother comes in and he sort of admits that he doesn't know what's going on. He said they're getting to his head. But yet that was at the end of that four-hour video and they only showed 2.5 hours of that video and didn't show the last 1.5 hours of that video where that was. Why wasn't that shown?
You know, I've never understood why that wasn't shown. I wasn't the attorney on the case. I was shocked that they would have the jury listen to all that.
Yeah.
Part of the after they stop, there is a section for maybe 15 minutes or something of more or less dead silence where the camera is still in there on Brendan Dassey, but nobody's there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, while they've gone out, and maybe in some cases you might not want to waste the jury's time by playing this sort of silent tape. But in this case where, you know, when you see how he behaves when he's alone, I mean, he's just looking like he doesn't know what he just said.
Mm-hmm. He thought he was going home.
He looked like a kid telling them what they wanted to hear. So, and then he says, can I go back to school now? Like
he genuinely
thought that.
Jerry, it was insane.
Yeah. And I fear my heart goes out to Brendan Dassey because I really, like, this is, he's not the brightest spark. He really did not know what was going on. And you think, and he's going to be in prison till 2048. It's ridiculous.
Well, and the sad thing is that happens all too often.
Yeah.
It's not unusual, though. The techniques, particularly that American police still use, you know, some of the UK and other English-speaking parts of the world have abandoned those very confrontational psychological techniques that really grew out of psychology from the 1950s.
Yeah.
And we now know better. But unfortunately, vulnerable people, whether it's juveniles or adults with, you know, mental capacity, limitations, whatever, are the most susceptible to falsely confess. And we know people do falsely confess because about 20 to 25% of exonerations involved cases where the defendant confessed.
Your joke.
Which is something they clearly did not do.
Yeah. And the fact that his lawyer was not on his side, and that was plainly evident. And yet, even when that was appealed, you know, to a higher and higher court, nobody seemed to see that. Did you understand why that appeal didn't work?
Well, the problem with appeals, a lot of times people think that, you know, that if the jury got it wrong and they just made the wrong decision, that don't worry, it'll get fixed on appeal. And that's not the way the appellate system works. And, you know, really the interest in a final judgment is much stronger than the interest in reversing in the interest of justice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It does happen sometimes, but generally it's very, very difficult to get a reversal on appeal.
Yep.
And
retrial?
It's very, that would be a reversal for a retrial.
Yeah,
what you get. In Australia, it's very difficult, even if once you go through your first appeal, as I understand it, then if new evidence comes up, you don't really have an opportunity to go back to court and present it again. You've got to appeal to the Attorney General or you know, other local politicians to try and get justice. So that's not fair either. You know, one of the things that hopefully will come out of this and the discussions that Dean and I have been having all over the country, you know, what can be done to correct our justice system, to make it more just?
But you know what,
Jerry? That's a long haul, mate.
It's corruption. And that's what it was.
Yeah.
To me, it just seemed like that town. Like, it all started from that cousin.
Yeah.
And that altercation they had, and she was with the police officer, and then they got outside of the police officer, and the family. excuse the language, was white trash enough for the community to revolt against them. It's just like, and then all I can see was corruption then afterwards. And I don't think you're ever going to be able to get rid of the corruption.
But changing a law, it's going to take an eternity to be able to get an eternity to get that through. It doesn't just happen overnight. And, you know, it's got to go through it's got to go through the state to be able to make that legal.
It, you know, it's not easy. It's not like you can make changes overnight, but, you know, people have done it. You know, we had a civil rights movement in America that just said, no, we're not going to take this anymore. And it took a while, but we've changed. We've now had an African-American president. So, you know, things can happen. It may be incremental, but people can't just give up and say, well, the system's corrupt and therefore nothing we can do about it. There are things you can do about it, but it does take people demanding change.
Yeah. Well, Hillary can do that. Trump won't be able to do that. Hillary could do that, I'm saying.
Hey, Jerry.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Can we talk about Stephen's mum and dad?
Oh, my God.
For those people and the fact that you see them in the course of the documentary.
And just her in the kitchen just sitting there waiting and, oh.
She went through every bit of information.
It was awful watching what they're going through. How are they doing, do you know? Are they okay?
You know, I think that they're optimistic now that there's more focus on what happened, that maybe they can finally get justice. But that's one of the unique things about this documentary. We often hear from the victim's family or, you know, spokespersons or whatever, but people don't realize how much a defendant's family suffers, too. And they're, you know, Dolores and Alan are very nice, ordinary folk that really have had a hard time navigating through a justice system that's now wrongly convicted their son twice. Mm. It's got to be immensely difficult for them, but somehow they, you know, they've kept their faith and they continue to hope for justice. And so do I.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. You know what? You and Dean deserve every accolade that you're getting at the moment, because I really love what you guys did for the justice system and standing up for, you know, something that was so wrong that I can't even believe it happened.
Yeah.
Every fangirl that loves you guys, you deserve it. The fact that people have printed out photos of Jerry and Dean and they've got them in frames at their homes. It's amazing.
The thinking woman's
sex symbol,
Jerry.
There is a Twitter account that follows their fashions during the court trial. These guys are huge.
That part I really have a hard time believing.
Jerry, fantastic.
It's so bizarre. You guys are headed our way. You'll be here on Tuesday the 1st of November at the Concert Hall. It's a conversation on Making a Murder with attorneys Dean Strang and Jerry Buting. Tickets are available now at livenation.com.au.
You know what? This will be worth going because we only scratched the surface here.
Yeah, we could have talked to you all day.
If you get the opportunity, make sure you have a look at this documentary. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's one of the reasons we're doing this tour in the first place, is that we realize the issues that are raised are really complex and worth talking about. And this is a forum where people can do it. They can ask us questions as well. We're looking forward to coming down there.
Mm. All right. Well, mate.
Between you guys and Serial, I tell you what, I'm hooked on American Crime. Jerry, thanks for talking to us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm really, really glad to have the opportunity. And like I said, Dean and I are really looking forward to coming. Neither one of us have been there before, and I hear it's beautiful.
Good on you, Jerry.
Good on you, Jerry. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.